This week we will begin our final series of messages from the Book of Judges, and our topic for this series will be Samson, perhaps the most famous of the judges. But as much as the name of Samson is well known, I think that the nuances of his story are not. Samson is sometimes thought of as the first superhero. He was a man of incredible strength, but who also had a fatal weakness. But beyond that, I would think that most know little about him, so I look forward to digging into the details of this character. Like everything else in the Book of Judges, Samson's story will have its twists, its ironies, and its moral ambiguities. So for the next 4 weeks, we will wrap up both the Book of Judges and the year 2020 by considering 4 chapters, those being Judges 13 through 16. This week we will consider Judges chapter 13, which records the unusual circumstances surrounding Samson's birth. So then, if you haven't yet read Judges 13, I recommend that you pause and do so now. The first verse of today's passage is a familiar one. Israel had done evil and thus had been given over to their enemies, this time the Philistines. And that is an ominous portent of things to come. As had been mentioned, Philistia would not be quickly dislodged and would be a thorn in Israel's side for generations to come. For more information on Philistia, you can listen to our recent message, Israel's Abuse of Grace, from November 8, 2020, which examined Judges chapter 10. Israel sinning and being given over to their enemies is the standard introduction to a new cycle in Judges. From there, we expect the story to turn to the deliverer whom God would raise up to rescue Israel. And in this case, perhaps because this judge's life was closer to the time when the book was compiled, ensuring that better records survived from which a compilation might be made, we have a record of the judge's birth. The story of his birth begins with a barren Danite woman, the wife of Manoah, otherwise unnamed. The barren woman miraculously giving birth to a chosen child is a recurring theme in the Bible. Notable examples could include Sarah, Abraham's barren wife who gave birth to Isaac at a very old age. Leaping ahead of that to the New Testament, there is Elizabeth, the wife of Zechariah, who gave birth to John the Baptist at an old age, having been previously barren. And perhaps most notably, Mary gave birth to Jesus. Now, Mary was not barren, she was simply a virgin, but that, I think, one-ups all the predecessors. It's hard to have a baby if you're old and you haven't had one before, but it's much harder to have one without even going through the baby-making process. So, miraculous births occurring where they aren't expected is a recurring theme, and we have it here as well. Manoah's wife was barren, but her fortunes changed when she was visited by the angel of the Lord, and her having a child demonstrated that there was a special work of God at play. If you are unfamiliar with this recurring character, the Angel of the Lord, I recommend that you listen to our message by that name, which was published on July 17th of 2016. There, we supposed that this character is likely the pre-incarnate Christ, and of course, we've seen appearances or references to the Angel of the Lord throughout the Book of Judges. I also recommend that you go back and compare this passage to the announcement to Abraham that Isaac would be born, because there are numerous similarities between the passages. We had a message on that, entitled Birth of Isaac, published on July 31st of 2016. The angel of the Lord appeared to Manoah's wife and assured her that though she was barren, she would have a son. The angel warned her that as a woman who would have a child, she should not drink alcohol or have any unclean foods. We note that modern scientific inquiry has supported the scriptures here. Drinking alcohol during pregnancy harms the unborn child, and it is important to have a healthy diet while pregnant. But this is no ordinary child and no ordinary pregnancy plan. This child was to be a Nazirite from birth, and in that capacity he would begin to save Israel from Philistia. Note that the passage says he would begin the work of saving Israel. He would not finish it. It is a foreboding line, to be sure. So, what was a Nazirite? Well, if you remember, you have access to our message on that topic. It is entitled Vows, and it was published on February 3rd of 2019. But for those who may not be in the know, you can find the description in Numbers chapter 6. A Nazirite vow was a vow made before God to be specially dedicated to him for a certain period of time. During that period of time, the Nazirite was required to avoid unclean things, even the dead body of a close relative, and to refrain from eating any product made from grapes, and to let his hair grow undisturbed. When the period of the vow was over, the Nazarite would offer sacrifices to God at the tabernacle and would shave his head and burn the hair as part of the offering. However, for this child, there would be no end to the vow. He was to be a Nazarite from birth and also till death. His hair was never to be cut. And in discussing the Nazarite vow, I think we do well to consider the role of grapes. Grapes were used for making wine. Wine is an alcoholic drink, and it seems evident to me that the avoidance of alcohol, or even the avoidance of the faintest connection to alcohol, is the reason that grapes and grape products were prohibited for the Nazarite. And concerning alcohol, I will tell you my personal preference. I have never once drank alcohol, and I would prefer that no one else drink it either. Alcohol is bad for your health, and consumed to excess, it is a deadly poison. You don't have to drink much of it before it will cause you to do regrettable things, perhaps even lethal things. It is expensive, it is a waste of your time and energy, it damages your brain, and it has seemingly no benefits. If you want to devote your life to God, my sincere recommendation to you is that you avoid alcohol entirely. That said, I'm not going to go so far as to tell you that the scriptures strictly prohibit alcohol consumption. The scriptures do prohibit drunkenness, that is, drinking alcohol to excess, but they do not prohibit drinking alcohol altogether. Jesus himself did drink alcohol, so I will not put a burden on you that I don't find in the scriptures. If you drink a small amount of alcohol and do not get drunk on it, it is no sin, my recommendations aside. But the Nazarite vow does demonstrate to us, at least on some level, that drinking alcohol is a deterrent to the closest possible relationship with God. In verses 6 through 7, the woman went back and reported this matter of the angel to her husband, Manoah. We note that she told her husband she had spoken to a man of God, and that he looked like an angel of God. And that leads me to wonder what an angel of God looks like, and how she would have known. I will remind you first that the word angel translates the Hebrew word melach, which means messenger. Sometimes it refers to a heavenly messenger, a non-human spiritual being sent as God's emissary in the world. But it can also mean a prophet, or even just a teacher. I will also remind you that our stereotypical image of an angel, one who wears a white tunic and sandals, who has angel wings and a halo, is not really biblically grounded. That's not to say that there's anything particularly wrong with it. Wearing white represents purity, a tunic and sandals were the normal garb of the time. The halo, a ring of light around the head, comes to us from the description of Moses' shining face when he came down from the mountain. And since he had that face having been close to God, we would think that God's messengers might also have a face like that. There are no descriptions of angels with wings in the Bible, but as heavenly beings, that being beings of the sky, it isn't a wild stretch to think that they could have wings. There is one depiction of some women in a vision of Zechariah having wings like a stork, but those aren't actually angels. And the seraphim, as described in Isaiah, are said to have multiple pairs of wings. But again, we aren't necessarily reading about seraphim here. We're reading about just an angel. All that the woman said in description to explain that the man looked like a messenger of God is that he was, to put it in the words of the ESV, very awesome, or from the KJV, terrible. Of course, those two words, to modern English ears, could denote two completely different things. If you like someone's cool skateboard trick or have fun with the latest video game, you might say, "That's awesome." Meanwhile, if you particularly hate math homework, you might say that it's terrible. The original English meaning of these words puts them much closer to each other, though. An awesome thing is that which puts you in awe, full of wonder and amazement, while a thing which is terrible is something which strikes you with fear or terror. So we can see how something would be both terrible and awesome at the same time. It is something simply greater and more powerful than yourself. You're amazed by it, but also a little scared of it. But here, the fear aspect is to be emphasized. The Hebrew word here is nora, and it implies fear and reverence more than awestruck wonder. So, what is it about the man that gives him a special frightfulness? And what about that frightfulness specifically connects him with God and not with some other kind of fear? I guess we can't say. She did mention that she didn't get his name, but she passed the message along to her husband. I'm going to have a baby, and he's going to be a Nazarite from birth. Naturally, Manoah wanted more information about this. If my wife was seemingly barren, and then she showed up pregnant and told me that an unknown man had told her that she would have a son and that I could never cut his hair, I don't think I'd just accept that with no further inquiry. And that is especially so since even if I did accept that on its face, it seems like I'd need further instructions on how to proceed from there. And so Manoah prayed to Jehovah, asking him to send the man of God back to give further instructions, and God granted the request. And so the messenger appeared to Manoah's wife, who was evidently out in the field, and she went to fetch her husband. Her husband inquired about what had been said. First, he asked the man if he was the one who had spoken to his wife previously, and he responded affirmatively. Now, it might appear to an English reader that he said, "I am," as in he responded by saying that he was the I am, that is, using the name of God. But that is not the case, so don't get too excited just yet. Manoah then asked if, indeed, the man's words came true and a son was born, what the child's mission should be, and what his life should be like. The messenger wasn't giving any more information than he had previously given. He repeated his command that she should avoid wine and unclean foods and not touch anything from a grapevine. But whatever it was that Manoah's wife had seen in the man, evidently Manoah saw it too, because he was willing to accept that information. And not only that, but he offered to feed the messenger. It was a very cordial offer, but the messenger refused, saying instead that he should make an offering to Jehovah. It is at this point that the passage explicitly tells us that this is no ordinary messenger that Manoah was dealing with, but that he was dealing with the angel of the Lord. And as we will find, the passage will very heavily suggest to us that this is a human manifestation of God himself. Manoah next asked the man his name, but the man refused to give it. He said that his name was, using an adjective, wonderful, meaning that it was too great for the man to truly comprehend. As for what exactly was meant by that, I'm sure I don't know. I suppose if I did, it wouldn't be something too great for man's comprehension. But I suppose it speaks to the greatness of God and the glory of his name. It was a pretty big deal for Moses when Jehovah passed him by and said his name. Moses wasn't even allowed to look on him as he did so. So this was something well above Manoah's pay grade. Verse 19 records that Manoah made the offering. And I will note that there is a small translational issue here. The English Standard Version has it that Manoah offered the sacrifice, quote, to the one who works wonders, end quote. While the KJV has it that Manoah offered the sacrifice, quote, and the angel did wondrously, end quote. You will note, if you are looking at the King James, that the word the angel are italicized. That is the King James way of telling you that the words were not in the original text and have been provided to help smoothen the reading. But in this case, they also presume that the doing wondrously describes the angel and not the one to whom Manoah offered the sacrifice. And that might be a quibbling point since Manoah was offering the sacrifice to Jehovah, and it turns out that Jehovah, as the angel of the Lord, was evidently the one who was standing there. So the angel did do something wondrous, and Manoah did offer his sacrifice to the one who works wonders, but we're studying the Bible here. We would like to know precisely that which God told us without any mixture of error. So which is it? As I read it here, the Hebrew includes a preposition which does describe the sacrifice as going to Jehovah. And it has a participle describing a male figure working wonders. That would validate the to the one who works wonders, or I would correct, to him who works wonders, idea. However, the King James reading is not meritless because there is a conjunctive vav in the middle of the phrase, so that it might most literally say, to do and wonder working. Well, that might justify and he did wondrously. He who? Well, likely the angel, and thus we get, and the angel did wondrously. The ESV actually has a footnote which says that they based their interpretation on the Septuagint and Vulgate, those being the ancient Greek and Latin translations of the scriptures. So evidently this has been a thorny little spot for some time, and I don't suppose that I have the expertise to untangle it for you. In the end, I suppose it is little matter because Manoah offered the sacrifice to the one who works wonders, and the angel did indeed do something wondrous. The angel of Jehovah ascended to heaven on the flame, and how exactly that worked is unclear. I get the idea that he stepped into the flame and then somehow transformed into the pillar of fire manifestation which Jehovah was known for using in appearances to his people. For more on that, you could listen to our message, Moses Parts the Sea, from October 22nd of 2017. I will note that stepping into a burning fire is probably the best way for any ordinary person to turn himself into something like a pillar of fire and to then go up as ash and smoke. But I suppose that this wasn't anything nearly so natural as all that, because Manoah clearly got the message here. This wasn't just some prophet, nor just some burning man. This wasn't just an ordinary messenger or even God's own heavenly messenger. This was no less than a manifestation of God, and he had revealed himself in accepting the sacrifice. And so Manoah and his wife responded in appropriate fashion. They put their faces to the ground in worship, and Manoah declared that they would surely die for having seen God himself. But then, as we have noted, it seems that would more appropriately apply only to seeing the Father. This physical manifestation is evidently of the Son, and thus does not result in death. But the wife assured Manoah, noting that if God had planned to kill them, he would have done it. He wouldn't have told them that they were going to have a son and would not have accepted their offering. And as it turned out, she was right. They didn't die. Much to the contrary, they had a son, and they named him Samson, and Jehovah blessed him. The chapter concludes with verse 25, which tells us that the Spirit began to stir him in Mahaneh Dan, that meaning the camp of Dan, between Zorah and Eshtaol. Now, I want to note for a minute here that the Spirit was at work in Samson. It's like we have a picture of the whole Trinity in this passage. Zorah and Eshtaol are marked on our map of Israel. They were in Dan's territory near to the southernmost point. We have discussed before that the tribe of Dan had great difficulty in taking their land, so much so that they mostly abandoned it altogether. See our messages on Micah and the Danites from August 2020 for more on that. Evidently, though, there was still a remnant of Danites hanging around in Zorah and Eshtaol on the border of Judah. The fact that they had a camp there indicates to me that they had a less than ideal living situation. Evidently, they hadn't taken cities, or at least not enough of them, such that they were still living in tents. Or perhaps they were encamped for war against Philistia. This statement that Samson was stirred by the Spirit in the camps of Dan might be an indicator that in his youth he had some experience as a soldier before the events that made him famous. Whatever the particulars, I am sure that it serves to us as a foreshadowing of things to come in his life. God began to work in him from an early age, and God would use him later in life. To conclude, then, today we have considered the particular events surrounding the birth of one of the Bible's most recognizable heroes, Samson. He was born of the tribe of Dan in a time when the southern portion of Dan was on the front lines of the resistance against Philistia. The Philistines ruled over Israel at that time because of their sin, and they would continue to oppress them for many more years. But Samson's birth offered a glimmer of hope. The angel of Jehovah proclaimed his miraculous birth to a barren woman, insisting, as will be key in the story, that Samson should be a Nazarite from birth, meaning that his hair should never be cut. In coming weeks, we will contemplate the incredible gift given to Samson, and the work which he did.
For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.